The Comic Book Time Machine, Episode 20. Marvel Sci-Fi Licensed Books, October 1977. At least Star Wars and John Carter are still good. Hello, time travelers. It's Ben Avery, and I'm here to talk about Marvel Sci-Fi licensed comic books. In particular, this time, from 1977, with a cover date of October 1977, and a release date of July 1977. So I've set the dial on my time machine, went back, and I brought back with me a handful of comics. Now, in case you were new to the podcast, this is how this works. Every month, I read the comic books that came out that month that Marvel licensed from movies or from books or, in one case this month, from a real-life stuntman. We'll get to them. We'll get back to them. Every episode, I have a box of comics, and I'll pull out the next polybag, and within that polybag, there'll be a couple comics, and there'll also be a list of what I'm supposed to read that month. So this month, we have Star Wars number 4, which costs a whopping 30 cents. We have John Carter, Warlord of Mars, number 5, which costs another whopping 30 cents. We have Godzilla, number 3, again, 30 cents. Human Fly, number 2. 30 cents. And The Island of Dr. Moreau, which I'm taking a look at because it was a sci-fi comic. It was licensed from the movie. It was also mentioned in an earlier announcement in the bullpen bulletin. So I'm going to go ahead and pull that out. A grand total of $2.20. Now, other books that were released this month, but that weren't shared, they didn't necessarily have the October 1977 cover date on it, but they were released July 1977. Speaking of, October 1977, that was the month that I would have turned 3 years old. And I have to say, actually, I have to ask, am I the only one who finds comic books with the month that is your birth month a little more special? Maybe a little better. Actually, better may not be the best word this month for 1977 with this lot of comics that I'm taking a look at, some of them anyway. But I always found it something, you know, unique. Whenever I get a comic book that has October as the cover date, even now, I'm not a kid anymore, but I see that and I just think to myself, oh, it's October. It's like a little birthday present from Marvel or DC to me. I don't know. It's like having a book, you know, a character in a book who shares your name, or a character in a movie who shares your name. You latch on to them. You know, you like them a little better than some of the other characters. I like Ben Grimm better than I like some of the other characters in Fantastic Four, solely because he has the name of Ben. Although this month is one reason why having that where you latch on to someone with your same name, in my case, Ben, isn't necessarily the greatest feeling. We'll get to it. So the other two things that I was mentioning that came out in July 1977 were John Carter, Warlord of Mars, Annual Number 1. I'm going to get to that in a minute. And then Marvel Special Edition featuring Star Wars Number 1. This book collects the first three issues of the Star Wars comic series. And so if you went and saw the movie and then you wanted more, well, you could go to the local comic place wherever you go to get your comics, the corner store, the Five and Dime, the grocery store, the gas station, whatever. It's quite possible you would have found Star Wars number 4 and Marvel Special Edition that collects the first three issues, and you would have had the story up to the date. You know, you still have to wait for 5 and 6 to finish the story, but you've got everything that they've published so far, and that's kind of cool. Now, they also did a Marvel Special Edition featuring Star Wars that collected the second half of the story, so you could have matching Treasury-sized editions. And then they did one that collected all six. And so the Star Wars issue number 1, it was reprinted a lot. So, now, the John Carter annual. I decided I wanted to do something special with the annuals, and so I'm going to do breakout episodes that are just focusing on the annuals. There aren't going to be a lot of annuals. Star Wars had a few, maybe I think three or four. John Carter, I think, had three. ROM, Space Knight had a couple. Micronauts had a few. I don't think any of the other series that I'm going to be covering actually had any. But whether they did or not doesn't matter. If I come to an annual, I'm going to do a breakout episode, and I want to do something special with it. And so one of the things I'd like to do is actually have a guest. And so I actually reached out to someone and asked them if I could interview them. And I have a very special announcement to make about who is going to be joining me during the episode about the John Carter Warlord of Mars Annual Number 1. I'm not going to tell you who it is right now. You're going to have to wait until the end of the episode to find out who is that special guest. However, when I told Daniel and Matt about who this guest was, man, oh man, I was so excited. And they are so excited. We can't wait. And I can't believe that this person, he actually said yes. And so, well, you just have to wait till the end of the episode for me to talk about that and give you the actual announcement. For now, I think it's time for us to get started and just get into the episode here. this month there was no 2001 A Space Odyssey, and strangely enough, I missed it. And actually, now that I think of it, maybe it's because of the strangeness that I missed it. Nothing this month is going to be as bonkers as 2001. Although I will say that there are going to be some strong reactions this month. Oh, boy. Well, I think we just need to get into it. Normally, I start with Star Wars. This month, this October 1977 coverage is going to be no exception. So without any further ado, Star Wars number 4, cover date, October 1977. Part 1, why did Ben have to die? Star Wars number 4, In Battle with Darth Vader. Cover date, October 77, which you already know. And the release date was July 12th, 1977. Just to get the credits out of the way here so we can get started, Roy Thomas was a scripter and editor. Howard Chaykin and Steve Lealoha were illustrators in tandem. What does that mean? I'm not quite sure, except for it seems like, well, we'll get into it. Tom Orzechowski, letterer, and Archie Goodwin, consulting editor. So the cover has us, it's an exciting cover. We have Ben Kenobi in a green robe looking like some sort of druid or something like that. He's got his lightsaber. He's getting ready to swing it. He's telling Luke, "No, no, Luke, here I stand, though I may die." And Luke Skywalker is trying to shoot his blaster at Darth Vader. Princess Leia is putting her hands up and wearing her ruby slippers. There's all sorts of interesting things going on in the cover here. The most interesting thing is that you have the hovering head of Darth Vader. And then the grasping hands hovering, looming over our cast. Still the greatest space fantasy film of all time there on the cover. It's a pretty good composition. We've got an ominous Darth Vader with his deadly hands reaching for the small figures of Luke, Leia, and Obi-Wan. And I can't help thinking that they're creating Star Wars iconography here. That looming head of Darth Vader, I remember very vividly in the Empire Strikes Back posters and on other covers and magazines and all sorts of things like that. But this giant head of Darth Vader with the giant hands reaching out for the, you know, the small and weak heroes. I think we're seeing one, if not the first time, one of the first times they're going to use this kind of symbolism and this kind of visual. In Battle with Darth Vader starts where we left off with issue 3. Now, this issue covers the movie from where they try to escape the prison block and go down into the trash compactor, and takes us all the way to the escape from the Death Star. So, you know, last time that first splash page, I spent a lot of time talking about it because it just, there was just so much to the composition there. And this one I look at and I don't have that same feeling. Now, it's not a bad page or anything like that. You know, we've got our main characters. They're in that hexagonal hallway and they're shooting at the stormtroopers who are coming their way. And there's lots of nice special effects. We got a grunk from Chewbacca. We get some zick, zick, zick and zrap and zick and zzz. We've got some good blaster sound effects. We also have five caption boxes 5 caption boxes of the backstory. You know, in case this was your first comic, probably I think it's very likely, actually, that people were picking this comic book off of the shelf because they had just seen the movie. I have a feeling that issue number 4 would be one of the first comics that a lot of Star Wars fans would have found because they went and saw the movie and weren't aware of the comic, and then they go into their, you know, local grocery store, the Five and Dime or whatever, and while they're there, they see Star Wars on the shelf, and they think, oh my goodness, I love that movie. So they get the caption boxes to just set the scene where we are. The first caption box actually says, we're kind of in a hurry this issue, so pay attention, and then gives all the backstory. And boy, oh boy, that caption box right there, that just sets the tone. This story is brisk. This issue is quick moving. It's all the escape stuff from the Death Star. You know, this is where they go into the trash compactor. This is where they go down the garbage chute and the droids have to hide from stormtroopers and the walls are closing in. And, you know, when I even think about this scene, I just hear that music, that droning, rising, just that tense music. And I read it here, and as I was reading it, guess what music I was hearing? I was hearing that tense music. And so the walls are closing in, the droids, they stop the walls from closing in just in the nick of time, and then it's the race to the Millennium Falcon. And meanwhile, Obi-Wan Kenobi is fighting Darth Vader in that promised fight from the cover. At last, the battle with Darth Vader to the death. That's what it promises us on the cover. And this time, the hyperbole, you know, no, Luke, here I stand, though I may die. Obi-Wan Kenobi never says that, but he may as well have. I mean, that this comic book cover delivers. A lot of times, comic book covers do not. Well, this is one that definitely does. It ends with the Millennium Falcon blasting away from the Death Star, and it's a very dramatic looking panel, very nice composition for the frame, and a perfect cliffhanger for this issue. The question is, from the beginning point to that end point, how does it work? And this is where things get a little iffy for me. First of all, the artwork in this book, there is a huge, huge quality drop from issue 3 to issue 4. When they say that the Star Wars movie adaptation art sucks, and I have heard a number of people say that, this, I think, is what they're referring to. I don't think they were talking about issue 3. Now, issue 3 was inconsistent, and it would go from a couple panels of photorealistic, almost, artwork to just kind of this cartoony, very loose caricature of the actors, or of the characters, even. And here in this book, the layouts are okay. The tech looks fine. Although going back to the layouts, almost every page has 6 panels. And there's no outside-of-the-box page layouts or anything like that. And there's no, like, in the last book we had some splash pages with inset panels. And there's, you know, kind of playing around with just the storytelling abilities that you have in a comic book page. And here, you don't get that at all. It is 6 panels, 6 panels, 6 panels. Slight difference in the layouts, but nothing unique, nothing odd. Everything is very balanced. Everything is very much, you know, it reminded me a little bit of Watchmen, where Watchmen intentionally just had that 9-panel grid. And you know, maybe there would be a panel that would take the whole top tier. So you don't get 9 panels on every page, but every panel is going to be part of that grid. And that was part of the genius of Watchmen, was actually to use that as part of the storytelling and as part of the pacing and everything like that. Here, it's 6 panels on every page because they have so much stuff to squeeze into this issue. I just don't feel like they're being innovative or anything like that. I feel like what they're doing is they're actually sitting down and saying, all right, what are we going to do? How can we squeeze this all in here? Well, it's by getting as many panels as possible. And, you know, it's Howard Chaykin and Steve Lealoha as illustrators in tandem. And so I can't help wonder if some of that just goes back to the fact that Howard Chaykin was not giving it his all. And so maybe he's taking Roy Thomas's outline. He's doing, you know, these page layouts. And as he's doing these page layouts, he's just doing it as quick as he can and not really thinking about how can I make this energetic? How can I make this fun? I'm just going to tell the story that I've got in front of me. And so then it goes to Steve Lealoha, and what is he supposed to do? Well, he's going to follow what Howard Chaykin's lead was, and there's not too much he can do to change that. On the other hand, I also wonder if maybe this is Howard Chaykin kind of pulling back and Steve Lealoha being forced to do some of these layouts and being forced to do some of the work there that he wasn't being that he wasn't doing before. I don't know exactly. All I know is these pages feel cramped and crammed, and this issue feels rushed. Now, going to the artwork about the characters and stuff, the characters are not on model. Which, you know, when I say that, I mean the characters do not look like the actors necessarily. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Honestly, with this issue, it almost feels like if they look like the actor, it's almost more of an accident as they're doing this kind of a more cartoony style. It's definitely a less detailed style. And honestly, you know, character is more important than actor. When you're doing a comic book, it's more important to have a consistent style and have a consistent character look than to try and get the character on model with every single illustration. And that's because that can get difficult. And so, you know, if I'm reading and I know who the characters are, that's really all that matters, as long as they consistently look one way or another. And this book at least has consistency with that, whereas the last one didn't. This one definitely has consistency, but man. The other thing here, though, is that while it's consistent, and I'll give it that as a bonus, the faces here, I don't usually get into artwork like this, but this just bugged me. The faces, it seems like... You know, you hear the rumors or, you know, all the things about the actors. Working with George Lucas, he'd always say, you know, faster, more intense. I feel like that's what they're doing on the page here with the comic book, is that, you know, Howard Chaykin or Steve Lealoha or Roy Thomas or someone is saying, faster, more intense. And every panel has energy. They're yelling. They're gritting their teeth. And I am sorry. I am very sorry, and I like the work of Howard Chaykin. I like the work that I've seen of Steve Lealoha, but Han Solo just looks like he has this "I'm pooping" face every other panel. If you took him out of context here, you could just, you know, have a panel where it just shows a bathroom door. And then the next panel is that Han Solo face, and it would just be like, yep, he's pooping. Anyway, that's what it looks like. And everyone in the whole book has this kind of distorted lips to, you know, to reveal their pearly whites. Everyone, you know, in almost every panel, they're showing their teeth. Almost never do you see anyone with a closed mouth where they're not showing off those bright, bright pearly whites. Except for one character. The one character who rarely shows his teeth through the entire book is Obi-Wan Kenobi. And that's because he's calm, and he's cool, and he's collected, and he's in control throughout this whole issue. Well, not throughout the whole issue, but throughout most of the issue. And so he wouldn't be having that energetic and yelling face. So let's talk about some of these moments here. The trash compactor stuff, it works. It works. I have a feeling that you're seeing stuff that they're trying to draw with very little reference to go on, but it works. It works nicely. One of these panels looks like it was taken directly from like the film where you have them all they're there. The camera's looking down on them. The walls are closing in. Han Solo's got the one bar up there. Chewbacca's pushing. Princess Leia has her legs out trying to hold it back, and Luke Skywalker's talking to the radio. It's a really nice panel. And then there's one interesting thing that you get that's not in the movie, is there's a panel of a tentacle reaching out to them after they are out of the trash compactor, and Han Solo shoots it as they are, you know, they're out of the trash compactor and the tentacle's reaching for them from the trash compactor. And I've always been curious about that tentacle, you know, and what that creature was like. ever since I was a kid. And then I saw the Phineas and Ferb Star Wars episode and found out. So they're running. There's lots of running. There's not as much detail in the storytelling here as there was in the movie as far as, you know, who was chasing them where. And I always felt the movie did a very good job of presenting us with geography and knowing they had to get from this level down to this level. And to get there, they had to go down these halls. And it's pretty good here. The one thing I would draw attention to is, has Princess Leia and Luke come to that one shaft where the door closes behind them and there's stormtroopers above and they're shooting down at them. And so Luke takes out the rope that he happens to have and he throws the grappling hook. I remember, you know, Princess Leia, she kisses Luke real quick. That was for luck kind of thing. And the way it's drawn in this book, first of all, it just feels very awkward knowing what happens later on. That kiss in this movie, it was never the one that people complained about. It was the kiss in Empire Strikes Back that was a little more awkward and Luke Skywalker's reaction to Princess Leia's kiss then. The kiss in Star Wars, there was nothing awkward about it. It was just a quick peck for luck. In the comic book, in issue 4 of the comic book, it is not a quick peck for luck. Luke Skywalker is going in. His mouth is parted. He is ready for action. And the dialogue, of course, does not reflect the paneling. Because Luke acts like he's surprised in the dialogue. He says, "What?" And Princess Leia says, "Just for luck. We're going to need it." And I'm just thinking, wait a minute. It looks like, I mean, they both have their eyes closed. And it's very uncomfortable. Of course, they don't actually show the kiss then, because then you turn the page, the very next panel, they're swinging. They're all the way across. I mean, it just feels like we missed a couple things here. But again, it's just that brisk, quick, breakneck pace. We got to keep going, keep moving. And that's a problem. There is so much crammed into this issue that there's no time for big reveals and no time for dramatic panels. Darth Vader's reveal is, On one page is a small panel out of 6. And it's actually when we first see Darth Vader and see that he's watching Obi-Wan Kenobi, the composition is fine. Although Darth Vader is definitely hard to draw, Darth Vader's face takes up half of the panel and then Obi-Wan Kenobi is in the other half, far, far down the hallway. And so there's our first look at Darth Vader as he's about to get Obi-Wan Kenobi. And then later on the next page, we cut to Chewbacca and Han Solo for a couple panels. And then Obi-Wan, he's on his way to the Millennium Falcon, but he stops because Darth Vader's in his way. And we get this small panel. And it's dramatic enough, I guess, considering the constraints of these 6 panel pages. But it's just a small panel with this small full body of Darth Vader. Darth Vader coming up to Obi-Wan Kenobi should be more dramatic, but there's just no room for it here. And I'm not going to hold it against the book because, again, Roy Thomas wanted 6 issues. And the reason he wanted 6 issues is because there was a lot of story to tell, and he wanted to be able to tell this story and tell it well. And so he's doing this in 6 issues, but he's still got more material than page space, I believe. And so when he's handing off these outlines to Howard Chaykin, it's just, here's this. And Howard Chaykin has to decide, how is this going to work? You know, and pacing and things like this is not easy, especially when you want to get everything in there. And I totally understand Roy Thomas's need here. I totally understand his want to include everything and be very true to the script. That's what I do. A lot of my comic book work is adaptation, where I'm taking someone else's story. In some cases, it's George R.R. Martin's story, and in other cases it's God's story, doing these Bible stories. And honestly, I almost wonder if it's the fans of George R.R. Martin who are more worried about changing things than the people who want to read the Bible stories. But you know, I had to make sure we did not leave anything out of Hedge Knight, because my job as an adaptation writer is to get out of the way and be invisible and get out of the way between the story and the art and just make sure that the story is going to be paced well and work. And so pacing is super important, but on the other hand, so is information. And so Roy Thomas had to make a choice. I've had to make that choice myself before. So I'm sympathetic. Let's put it that way. But this is still moving really fast. The lightsaber battle. Here it is. Obi-Wan Kenobi. He activates his lightsaber in one panel. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 panels on one page. So they do break it, you know, pull back from the 6. 5 panels on one page of Darth Vader and Obi-Wan fighting. Lots and lots of words on those pages. Lots and lots of descriptions, you know, telling them, saying that they're like titans out of some lost time. He makes a sudden lunge, but is checked by a lightning movement. Even as they fight, Ben seems to be under increasing pressure and strain, as if an invisible weight were being placed upon him. A lot of words. The narration, it feels okay. It feels good. But this fight is just really abrupt. Like I said, there's 5 panels on one page here. And then we cut to our kids, the kids, and they're talking about, what do? We have to run across to get to the Millennium Falcon. All of a sudden, you know, they notice, wait, the stormtroopers, they're moving out of the way. And that's half of that page. And then you have 3 panels of Darth Vader and Obi-Wan again. Zap, zzz, whatever. And then Darth Vader strikes the killing blow. Now, I do want to spend some time on the killing blow. First of all, this scene makes me sad. Every time I see it, I know what's coming, but it makes me sad, and it makes me sad for a number of reasons. One is, when I was a kid, I felt sad to see Obi-Wan Kenobi be killed. Another thing is, when I was a kid, my name being Ben, I always felt a connection to characters named Ben, except for Benji the dog. In fact, Benji the dog is the reason I'm not Benji anymore. Third grade, I came home one day and said, I don't want to be Benji anymore because people at school are calling me Benji the dog. After that day, little Benji turned into Ben. He was growing up, becoming his own person, becoming his own man. I, of course, you know, you feel an affinity to characters who share the same name as you. And so I felt an affinity to Ben Kenobi, and then he dies. You know, he dies right before the second act is done. And so we still have a full act of the movie to get through where we're not going to even see him. We'll hear him, but we're not going to see him. The other thing I felt bad about is that whenever we would play Star Wars on the playground, guess who had to play the part of Obi-Wan Kenobi? Ben. Why Ben? Because his name was Ben, and so was Obi-Wan Kenobi. I had to play the guy who was going to die. No matter what, I was going to be the guy who had to die. And so then, maybe I'd be allowed to stick around and be a blue space ghost, but anyway. The panel is weird, though. In the movie, you just see the lightsaber comes, the robes, they fall, and the same thing happens in the script. I was looking at the script to see how it was written, and it's the same kind of thing. It wasn't until later drafts that Lucas decided he was going to kill off Obi-Wan Kenobi, because he realized that for the that third act of the movie, Obi-Wan didn't have anything to do. And so he decided, well, it has to happen here. And then you kind of get into some of the myth, the Joseph Campbell hero's journey myth that feeds into that, but it's very quick. And in the movie, in the script, it just says that his lightsaber slices the robes in two, but the robes fall and they're empty. Now the robes do fall and they're empty, and Darth Vader does investigate the robes. But the panel where Obi-Wan Kenobi dies, it's this crazy. It's got the sound effect is rack, and the lightsaber is like buried in Obi-Wan's chest as it slices through. His robes are orange and yellow, and there's this wavy line work to his details, to Obi-Wan's details, as his face looks like this cartoonish, freakish, rah, scream of pain. This guy is dying painfully. He is exploding. There's red lines in the background. They're just like these explosive lines shooting out from his body. I look at this and I think, wow, that is very, very different. That is very, very different than what we saw in the movie. Now, here then, when Luke Skywalker cries out and shouts, and that's where the stormtroopers notice that they're there at the Millennium Falcon, the emotion there, that exaggerated emotion, works really, really nicely. And then you have the voice of Ben Kenobi telling him to run and to go. And you get this one brief moment where Luke sits there and says, I can't believe he's gone, which we get from the movie. And then the Millennium Falcon blasts away from the Death Star. And the next issue then is Escape to the Moons of Yavin. I like the ending, that last panel, a lot. But getting from the first splash page to this last panel, like I said, man, we are moving, and we are moving fast. So, first half, crammed. Second half, okay, but crammed. And the ending, that last panel, super good. And much of this, I think, feels like this, though, like I said, because I think Chaykin was just pulling back, and that's unfortunate. Now, issue three felt rushed, but this feels like they are just pushing too fast to the point where it almost feels like it's falling apart. I don't think it's terrible. Don't get me wrong. It's not bad, but it's not the best. And I am then starting to worry about issue five and issue six. And I'm also starting to get excited about issue 7. I want to see some of those new stories. Now, sales here were very, very good. And this was definitely a boon to Marvel. And this is also then the month that issue 4 comes out. But the issue, the Treasury edition that contains issues 1 through 3 also came out this month. Star Wars was a certifiable hit for both 20th Century Fox and for Marvel. So I do want to mention, though, speaking of Howard Chaykin, I mentioned that I found my Monarch Starkiller comic book, and I read it, and it's good. It's good. I had forgotten what happens there. Chaykin wrote and drew it, and it's basically a space western, and it's literally about a bounty hunter who flies into town on a mining planet, and he's in search of a killer. The killer is there because he's planning to do some sort of assassination plot, and so you kind of get into some of the politics of the town. It feels like a western because not only are they riding horses, but these guys walk off the spaceship and they're wearing spurs as they walk off the spaceship. I mean, come on. Yeah, we get it. This is a space western. This is not meant to be just any old, you know, sci-fi pulp thing. I mean, we're going for western here. And it works like that. It's standard, but enjoyable. It does predate Star Wars, although because of the timing of when that comic book would have been worked on and the timing of when they would have started working on the Star Wars book, I was led to believe that this was something that Lucasfilm was looking at and appreciating, and that's why they wanted Howard Chaykin. However, because of the timing of when his Monarch Star Killer would have come out and Star Wars would have started, you know, coming to him, I almost wonder if there is a little bit of Star Wars influence on Monarch Starkiller. I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm not sure about the timing there, but it could be. Anyway, it's an enjoyable read. I recommend it to you if you like that kind of thing. If you like, you know, the genre mashups and that kind of thing. This book, what separates it from just being a Western in space, is that it does give the hero sci-fi cyborg powers, and he has a sci-fi weapon, and there's kind of some elements of the Force and lightsaber here. Whether it's, I mean, it very well could be coincidental, because the cyborg powers he has are a telepathic and cybernetic link to a mechanical hawk, and it's kind of cool. It's from Marvel Premiere. And Marvel Premiere was kind of a tryout book from my understanding. And Marvel, honestly, I'm surprised that they didn't, but they, maybe because it was Howard Chaykin and he was just kind of falling off the book with Star Wars. But Marvel could have tapped that for some new sci-fi to get in on the Star Wars bandwagon that they were already riding with the actual Star Wars book. But on the other hand, they already had something that was definitely something you could hitch onto the Star Wars bandwagon, and it's something that premiered the month before Star Wars premiered, as far as issue one came out the month before Star Wars issue one came out. So they already had another pulpy space fantasy that they could kind of call on to ride those coattails. And so with that said, I'm going to go ahead and I try to decide, am I going to do this next? Or am I going to, you know, do it last and let it cleanse the taste out of my mouth? But I think we're going to go ahead and do part two right now. And part two is going to be a high point, and that is John Carter. Part two, Giant Battle Issue. For this part, we're going to talk about John Carter, Warlord of Mars. Number 5, again, October cover date, 1977. Release date was July 26, 1977. And all I can say is, oh my goodness, I'm so glad that I got to read John Carter, Warlord of Mars. Generally speaking, my reading order, not the order for recording, but my reading order is I read Star Wars first, everything else in the middle, and then John Carter last. Because I have found that John Carter is just that cool, refreshing lemon meringue pie after eating some, you know, not particularly fresh vegetables for dinner. You start out with Star Wars, and it's enjoyable, although not necessarily the greatest, especially this particular round, October 1977. John Carter, so far, all 5 issues, every time I've read a John Carter book, it's just been so nice and exciting and interesting and surprising. Every single time I have been surprised by something when I've been reading John Carter, Warlord of Mars. John Carter, Warlord of Mars, number 5, promises it's going to be a giant battle issue. And guess what? It delivers. It shows Stara Khan fighting John Carter right there on the cover. Deja Thoris is watching in the background, a giant floating head. There's a theme for the covers here. Giant floating heads in the background. And then you have someone saying, "Stand back! John Carter and Stara Khan must fight to the death." Another theme. This is kind of odd. Star Wars and John Carter, Warlord of Mars, they're kind of having some, what do you call that, synchronicity? It's a well-drawn cover, and it draws you in. It's Gil Kane and Pablo Marcos, who's doing the cover here. Let's just get right into here. Let me set the scene for what we're getting into. We start out, we're not with John Carter, we're not with Stara Khan, we're not with Deja Thoris, we're not with Tars Tarkin, we're not with any of those guys. We actually start out, it's Friday night, or whatever passes for a Friday night on Barsoom, and it's Friday night, it's at the bar, all the working class men, they're there, they've got their big drinks, and they're just having a rowdy time. It's Friday night. Everybody's working for the weekend, you know? And after a hard day's work, talk starts, you know, going into directions that it probably shouldn't be when you're tired, but you're excitable, you've been drinking, and talk goes to politics, as it does. And you have your lefties, you have your righties, they're divided on the issues of the day. And on Barsoom, on that particular day, well, the issue of the day is, did John Carter kidnap or kill the princess Deja Thoris or not? And so the conversation gets a little bit louder, and one side saying no, John Carter is not guilty. The other side, you know, they believe that he's guilty. So a bar fight erupts. Kantos Khan and Grog are leading the charge in John Carter's defense, and then Deja Thoris' father interrupts, and you remember last issue, he said, you know, he's going to find out what's going on, he's going to find his daughter, and he's going to find the people responsible, and he's going to hold them responsible, even if it is John Carter. But he needs fighting men to help him on this mission, and he has come to the right place, because, well, they're actually already fighting, you know? And so he brings them, they go to train everyone. Republican and Democrat alike, they are united with that moment. They are united with that purpose. They are just going to put aside their differences, and they are going to try and help them find Deja Thoris. And whoever is responsible, they are going to hold them responsible and give them the consequences deserving their crime. And, of course, one side of it, they're doing it, and they're out for John Carter's blood, while the other side is doing it because they want to defend him and help him. Because, obviously, John Carter cannot be doing what he is accused of, right? And what's he accused of? Attacking cities and stealing precious artifacts and fighting his allies and even, in some cases, killing them. So we cut to John Carter now, who is attacking cities and stealing precious artifacts and fighting his allies and even in some cases killing them. Remember, he's doing this to bide his time until he can rescue Deja Thoris. And everything he does for her, everything I'm not going to sing. I am holding back. I'm not going to sing. Deep breath in and out. Okay. So, he is in the middle of battle, and when someone attacks with deadly force, he has to defend himself with deadly force in return. He's forced to, and he hates it. So, after he kills someone who was attacking him, he determines, he vows that this is not going to happen again. It will not happen again. He will not let it happen again. Actually, what he says is, he has this moment of realization where he knows the truth. He says, I was Starakhan's stooge. I did what he ordered me to do. Now, who was Starakhan? Just a quick reminder. This is the man that in battle during the first book, Princess of Mars, that John Carter was in, while they were having a battle, they were having a war, John Carter wounded this man and caused him to lose his arm. His arm was replaced by a robotic arm, cybernetic cyborg arm. And so this man wants revenge on John Carter. And the way he's been taking it out on him is to kidnap Deja Thoris, hold the whole planet hostage, basically, because they're taking control of the air controllers and stuff like that. But then is forcing John Carter to work for him as a sky pirate, because this is, by the way, not just called The One Shall Die. This is chapter 5 of The Air Pirates of Mars, even though they don't mention it. And so what you have then is Starakhan saying, you are going to go on these missions. You are going to fight these people. You are going to steal their most precious artifacts. And basically, he's doing this smear campaign, this really violent, brutal smear campaign, forcing John Carter to smear his own name because he holds the fate of Deja Thoris. And until Deja Thoris is safe, John Carter is forced to do this. And unfortunately, it has resulted in a few deaths. So he goes on to say, in the past, I was no one's fool. I fought for what I believed in. I swore then and there that Khan would own me no more. So he's on the big flying pirate ship. He goes to kill Starakhan. He's not even in his quarters. So then he looks at the logbook, sees some coordinates, steals a flying ship, flying lifeboat kind of thing, to go and find Starakhan. Well, the coordinates take him to this huge, huge base. It's almost like a small city of buildings and skyscrapers and stuff inside a dead volcano. And now it is enemy fortress infiltration time. A giant nasty spider gets in the way? No, that's not going to stop John Carter from his mission. He runs away before the spider can do anything, which was a little bit disappointing. He gets caught on the web and he just cut himself out and runs away. We don't have time for this, though. We don't have time to fight spiders. We have to get moving. A maze of buildings in his way, is that going to stop him? No, he's going to go to the tallest one. And then he's going to start, he jumps up the building and he does this telepathic thing that I can't remember if I knew this or not, that he had that power, but he's trying to find Starakhan's exact location using this kind of telepathy thing, and he swings down. He is going to take Starakhan down. Now, he gets there just in time to hear Starakhan remind one of his lackeys, don't forget I left my arm buried in helium, not in the element helium, but in the city of helium. And thank you for reminding me of that, Starakhan, because I'd forgotten about your arm. Apparently that's going to be a plot point coming up. There is something else coming up that I also needed to be reminded of, but I'll get to that in a second. I completely forgot, just like actually John Carter. So he crashes through the window. Glass is not going to stop him. Giant spiders, lots of buildings, glass, it's not going to stop him. Where's the giant battle we've been promised? Ah, here it is. He starts punching. He starts kicking. He's swinging his dagger. And he says, it's you and me, Starakhan, face to face, as it was destined to be, one-on-one, mano-a-mano. Starakhan says, well, no, actually not. Remember that collar you're wearing that you've been wearing for the last few issues? It allows me to have control over you, and I am going to destroy you without even lifting a finger, because I'm just going to wound you, hurt you, and this is how it's going to happen. Well, John Carter shames him in front of his men. He says, look what he won't even fight me. Look, everyone! Stara Khan, there he is, and he's not going to even fight me! What are you? Chicken! Well, that does it. I mean, he doesn't use those exact words, but the words he uses are pretty much the magic words. He shames him in front of his men, and he says, well, fine, we will fight one-on-one, and we will fight evenly, with no extra weapons. I will not use the collar against you. They fight Super Earthman versus Cyborg. And, okay, giant battle issue. Well, as far as the actual giant battle, it's only three pages from the end here, but they fight, and it is brutal. The art just sells it. And boy, the battle between Darth Vader and Obi-Wan, you want to compare it to the battle here? Oh, there is no comparison. No comparison at all. They fight, and finally, and actually, I think there was about the same amount of, well, no, this has a little bit more extra page time, but John Carter grabs that robot arm, and he is going to take that robot arm off. He tears the arm off. Starcon lunges for a gun. And then we have this moment where they come, they grapple together, the gun is in between them, the trigger is pulled, and kawam! Starcon speaks, it's over, Carter. At last it is over. And I've won. You may have killed me, but only I know where Deja Thoris is hidden. And John Carter then narrates, and he died, mocking me all the way to hell. We have this laughter in the background that Irv Watanabe does a great job with the kwam and the ha ha ha. Yes. Well, looks like old John Carter is stuck in a bit of a pickle here. It's... His own people are out to get him, the people that he actually, you know, he's one of their leaders. They're out for him. They want to kill him for kidnapping or killing Deja Thoris. But Deja Thoris is still in danger, so on the one hand, they all want the same thing. They want to help Deja Thoris, but on the other hand, John Carter is in a mess here. He is a trapped man. And I know the trap will not kill him. But this book keeps surprising me, because here's the deal. Yes, I know he's not going to die, but remember what I said before, that sometimes it's all about how we get there, not what we're going to. We know what the destination is going to be, we just don't know where and how we're going to get there. And honestly, my goodness, this book has just been, like I said, it just keeps surprising me. And in this issue, the free will ideas in the previous issue bleed through. Last issue, John Carter could not act on anything unless he was forced to do it by Stara Khan because of the collar and because of the Deja Thoris thing. And then you had that creature that was mind-controlling everyone. And he's trapped and he's controlled, but he is taking matters into his own hands now. He is choosing, and he is choosing based on rage and based on helplessness, so he is lashing out. And you could make the case that he is not making good choices here. When he finally has the ability to choose for himself, the choices he makes are not the greatest. But he's making these choices and he's facing the consequences. And I love that about storytelling. That's where this book is just, I want to know what's going to happen next. I can't wait to read issue number 6. And the other thing was, I, like him, I forgot all about the collar control thing. And I forgot all about the buried arm. And those are small details that Marv Wolfman is using over time and actually seems to be, you know, putting thought into the plotting here and deciding, you know, this is where the cliffhanger is going to be, and we're going to take a left turn here to fight this monster, or take a right turn here to run away from this spider. But Marv Wolfman knows what he's doing here, and I am loving the ride. Gil Kane and Rudy Nebrez, they nail the art again. It's just, it's perfect for what the storytelling is wanting to do. Irv Watanabe, he wins for best lettering of special effects. I'm not sure about, you know, what is the best special effect this month with but the kwam, it's up there. I like that. And even the coloring, Janice Cohen's colors too. This is a team working well together. This is a team that has, I don't know if they found their stride, but I can't say they found their stride, because they were doing good at the beginning. They're doing really good now. So I just have to say, like I said, I am looking forward to finding out what happens next. I'm trying to, you know, try not to flip forward right now as I'm talking. So, yeah, this team, they are working well together. Unlike a team from part 3 in the next book. No, not the creative team, but the teamwork of the... Well, you'll see. Part 3. We are the champions, my friend. Ooh. Yeah, sorry. But that's what I'm calling part 3 here. Godzilla number 3. From October 1977. As, you know, all of them. Issue 2 didn't leave me with very high hopes about the Godzilla series. And so, I can enjoy bad comics. I can enjoy bad movies. I can enjoy juvenile fun. I can enjoy something that's meant for kids that's good. And I think it's safe to say that last issue was meant to be juvenile fun, meant for kids. That's what Mensch wanted, right? That's what he wanted. He wanted to do something that would pull in the kids. But then he also was talking about how it would have crossover appeal and it'd be something for the older set, too. So, I don't know. I mean, they were also going to use this to kind of explore the Marvel Universe for people who wouldn't know the Marvel Universe. And so this would be what they're doing here, issue 3. Now, does it work? Is it a comic for older readers and younger readers? Well, we'll find that out later on. But we've got Doug Mensch, who's the writer, Herb Trimpe, who's the artist, Tony Dezuniga, the inker, Wool and Watanabe, the letterers, two letterers on this, Don Warfield, the colorist, and Archie Goodwin, the editor. And as I said before, this is one of those issues where they're definitely trying to expand the reader's understanding and knowledge and familiarity with the Marvel Universe by bringing in some Marvel characters. Not just Dum Dum Dugan, and not just Gabe, and not just S.H.I.E.L.D. with Nick Fury, but we've got the champions here. The champions. The title of the book is A Tale of Two Saviors. And we'll get... I don't really understand how that works. No one really does any saving here. They do some... Well, they just don't... Let's just put it this way. The champions and the shields are not put in their best light here. And I understand that the champions, this month, they didn't have an issue out. And following this, there were only going to be one or two more champions issues. And so as I'm looking at this, I'm just thinking to myself, this did not do them much good for their numbers, putting them in a Godzilla book. But starting with the cover, though, I love the cover. I love the cover. It says, to challenge the champions. And you have Godzilla's face in the background as he's peeking over some sort of... I think they're on a bridge, probably the Golden Gate Bridge, which is what we're in San Francisco for this. Angel's flying, and he's kind of yelling and shouting excitedly. Iceman, he's got his ice ramp that he's sliding up, which defies all physics, but it's okay because... Then they used it to nice effect on Spider-Man and his amazing friends. And Godzilla, he doesn't care about these two guys. Hercules picked up a chunk of the bridge and has thrown it at Godzilla's face, man. And then you have Black Widow, who's lying there helplessly on the ground. And honestly, Black Widow is the only character there who's acting realistically. I don't think the boys get quite how helpless the situation is here. If I was Angel, I would not be flying toward Godzilla unless I was flying to try and pull someone out of his teeth. You know, maybe Angel could rescue someone from Godzilla, but to actually think that you could do any good there, no. And Iceman, pal, buddy, friendo, what are you doing? You actually think you can zap Godzilla with your ice and do, well, yeah. You do think that, don't you? Hercules, there's a little bit of realism there. I mean, he is a demigod. But, yeah. But I still love the cover, because it's got some of my favorite Marvel characters, and it's got Godzilla. And of all the issues I would like to own from this Essential Edition, this is the one. This is the one. I might come across another one, and I've only read 3. But this is the one. So... inside we have our opening splash, and Big G is standing right by the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge, and the Coast Guard is there, and they're trying, the police rather, they're in their police boats. They're trying to figure out what to do about things, which really, guys, you can't really do too much about it. I do have to bring this up, though. Godzilla, he's there. He's standing by the Golden Gate Bridge. He's not going past it. He's not pushing through it. He's not going under it. He's not doing anything. He's just right next to it. And I'm reminded of the new Godzilla movie, which I kind of enjoyed. I actually kind of liked. But that's an argument for another day. Anyway, the police don't know what to do. And so what are they going to do? Well, they decide to shoot him with their machine guns. I don't know exactly what they think is going to happen. The comic book definitely is not forgiving to them of doing this. Godzilla destroys their boats. Then you cut to the champion skyscraper. And here you have Hercules and Black Widow. They're sharing a little quiet time. And it seems like there's some sort of romantic inclinations here. I'm not sure. But Hercules is definitely trying to reveal some feelings about Black Widow. I don't know about love, but there's definitely some feelings going on there. So they see there's an alarm that goes off in the computer room. So they run in there and they see a news report on their big screen TV computer thing that shows Godzilla standing by the Golden Gate Bridge. Now, the champions, they're in Los Angeles, you know, just a few hours drive, depending on traffic. And so, you know, why wouldn't they do something about this? Who else is going to do something about this? Now, it's just Black Widow and Hercules. They're getting ready to go. But as they get ready to leave, Angel and Iceman walk in. And Black Widow says, "Angel, Iceman, where are the others?" And Iceman says, "I don't know about Ghost Rider, Widow, but Darkstar is out doing her... dash, dash. Never mind, Bobby. The four of us will have to do. Come on. I'll explain in the champ's craft." Now, the champions is a team that really... honestly, I can't believe that it lasted as long as it did. It's an interesting concept, and it was interesting reading some of the background information about where the champions came from and some of the restrictions that were put on them, because it started out as something where they wanted it to just be like a road trip kind of thing. You know, Angel and Iceman, while they're not in the X-Men magazine having new adventures there, they were going to have adventures, you know, going across the nation or something together. They were going to be champions together. I don't know exactly what it would have been called, but then the restrictions were put on them. You need a character who has his own book to be in this team. You need a woman on this team. You need a character who doesn't have his own book on this team, and all these kind of restrictions. And I hope actually to do an episode about the champions. Again, I don't have the issues. I have issue number one somewhere in my collection that I got just because it had Angel and Hercules on the cover. But beyond that, I don't have the Essential Edition, which I would like to. Anyway, they decide they're going to go, and they're going to take care of Hercules. So they get in the champ's craft, and they head on their way. Meanwhile, back up at Seattle, where they last saw Godzilla, the helicarrier is still in Seattle, and Dum Dum Dugan is howling mad, my friends. And he says, "That stinking monster's already made us look like monkeys twice now. And that's three strikes is all you get in Papa Dugan's book." And you have to remember, other than Godzilla, this is Papa Dugan's book. This is Dum Dum's book. So they find out that Godzilla is in San Francisco, and so you have the helicarrier turn around, and it's going to head to San Francisco. At the bridge, the champions launch into action. Big G turns around from the bridge, heads towards Fisherman's Wharf, where police then open fire on him there. And while they open fire, that causes his tail to twitch, and Angel happens to be flying nearby, so he gets hit by Godzilla's tail. And that's pretty much all the action you're going to get from Angel, which is disappointing to me, because I think I've said this before, Angel is my favorite X-Man, one of my favorite characters of all time. I like a lot of things about him. He's knocked unconscious, but here is where, oh my goodness, this is where the book becomes worth the price of admission, because Godzilla, he's not actively going after Angel. He accidentally hit him with his tail, and now he's about to accidentally step on him. But Hercules is right there. Hercules runs. The foot comes down. Hercules is holding the foot of Godzilla on his shoulders. I mean, this is Atlas stuff. You know, Atlas holding up the world. This is Hercules saying, I'll hold it for you to give you a break. This is Hercules being Hercules, the Hercules of myth, the man who is part God. This is awesome, because then you turn the page and you get one of the best page turns in this book. It's a splash page of Hercules, tiny in the bottom corner, tossing up Godzilla's foot and flipping Godzilla back, leveling four blocks. It says four square blocks of evacuated buildings are immediately flattened. I'm glad it was evacuated. But oh my goodness, I love this page. I want this comic book in color. And instead I have it in this black and white essential edition, and it still is just making me cheesily grin as I see that page. It is awesome. Demigod versus Godzilla. Hercules versus the Big G. And if that's what this comic is going to be, this is going to be awesome. The super strong insect battling the gigantic monster as he dodges blows from the creature's feet and fire breath and tries to punch and tries to pull. And this would be Hercules straining with all of his might. This could be so awesome. Spoiler warning, it's not. It's all downhill from here. And when I say downhill, it is a speedy, speedy, steep hill that we are sliding down right now when S.H.I.E.L.D. shows up. Dum Dum wants to drop a trap on Godzilla called Electromagnet. Yes. Kind of cool. The picture of it looks like a fishnet bra or something, I don't know. But he's standing there and he's like, we're going to do this, we're going to drop it on them. And then he sees on the screen, there's the champions, and now he's all mad because there's superheroes here and superheroes shouldn't be here. And so he orders the attack, and then we cut to Tony Stark halfway across the country. We have our supporting cast, the scientists from Japan, including Rob... the Kenny, who, as they're looking around, as the others are being shown around and they're talking about, you know, there's our computer systems, we're going to use this, it's going to be great, Stark International is going to help you out. Rob Takaguchi, he says to himself, the security here will not be too difficult. Rob, why do you have to be such a Kenny? Anyway, back to the battle. They try their plan. They're going to drop these electrified nets on Godzilla. But Dum Dum, he's got his flying tricycle bikey thing. And he's flying up to give the orders. He's telling the amateurs to get out of the way. These guys aren't amateurs, by the way. I mean, this is Black Widow, Hercules, and two X-Men. But Angel flies by, and it causes Dum Dum to go off track. He flies his thing into Godzilla's mouth, and he jumps out just in time, and Angel's able to help him out, but Godzilla falls into the water, disappears, and then rises up out of the water right under the San Francisco Bridge. That's poor, poor planning. This whole thing just bugs me. I mean, S.H.I.E.L.D. looks like idiots, Angel looks like an idiot, Iceman freezes Godzilla's head, of course that doesn't do anything. They're going to drop the nets, but then they notice that Hercules is swimming out to meet Godzilla in the San Francisco Bay. So they call off the attack, but he calls it off at the wrong time. And so now the nets are falling, but they're going to fall in the wrong place. Hercules goes under the water, picks up a piece of the Golden Gate Bridge, throws it at Godzilla. Godzilla just ducks, literally ducks. The bridge flies over his head, and it hits the helicarrier. And the helicarrier then dives into the San Francisco Bay. Honestly, I'm expecting the Benny Hill music to start playing, that, you know, kind of... I mean, this is just clown shoes, man. This is clown shoes. This is poor writing. I mean, I understand they want to have conflict between the two groups, but come on. Come on. Hercules accidentally sinking the helicarrier and crashing it into the bay. Oh, by the way, another thing we're seeing in movies. This Godzilla comic book here is predicting Captain America Winter Soldier and Godzilla. It's predicting 2014 in big summer blockbuster movies. So it crashes in, and there's just some weird stuff going on now, where you have Godzilla squeezes part of the helicarrier, and it says, then, without hate, and almost playfully, in fact, his claws close around one of the helicarrier's dorsal fins. It crumples with a weary groan. Later, one of the crew will liken the curious gesture to that of a wistful uncle tweaking his cute nephew's button nose. The crewman, it should be noticed, or should be mentioned, is far more perceptive than anyone suspects, including himself. And now, almost shrugging, or so it seems, Godzilla turns his back on the chaos. That same crewman will later claim the big lug looked like he was bored with the whole mess. And he just walks away. And of course, Dum-Dum can't go after him. This is the third strike, by the way, Dum-Dum, and it's your book. What's going on here? And it's just, then we get a G.I. Joe knowing is half the battle moment, where we get the moral of the story. And Dum-Dum's yelling, "You see? You see what your costume clowns have done? We just blew the bridge and the helicarrier, and Godzilla's walking away from it without a scratch." And Gabe says, "Easy, Dum-Dum. Wasn't just the champion's fault. The rap hangs on all of us." Angel says, "Yeah, we all acted like kids, and as a result of our juvenile competition, we lost sight of the real adversary." Gabe, back to Gabe, "Let's just chalk it up as a lesson for the future, Dum-Dum, and get the helicarrier into the hangar." Dum-Dum finally says, "Ah, you're probably glad Godzilla got away again, Jones. You've gone soft on the blasted monster." After the two groups have separated, a somewhat mystified Iceman will ask, "Now, what do you mean by that?" The Black Widow will philosophically reply, "Who knows? But the other one was right about this being a lesson. We still have much to learn about being a team. Let's go home, champions, without taking our name too seriously." Wah, wah, wah. Yeah, champions, you've got two more issues. I don't think you're really going to learn your lesson from this before you have a... Well, I don't think you're going to learn your lesson while you still have a team. Let's put it that way. Ugh. So, okay. I like members of the champions. I'm a fan of Black Widow because of the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe where, you know, and I talk about Marvel Cinematic Universe on another podcast, Welcome to Level 7. I like Hercules because of the Bob Layton miniseries that take place in the future. Future Hercules is a very, very fun title to me. Angel, Iceman, they're part of my team of five X-Men that I think of when I think of X-Men, and Angel is my favorite of all of them. Godzilla, I like him. And Hercules, throwing Godzilla is worth the price of admission to me. But the juvenile antics, the shenanigans, you know, that should have been accompanied by yakety sax. I mean, this just isn't good. This isn't good. Now, maybe I'm bitter here. Maybe I'm bitter because Angel just got hit by a tail and that makes Dum-Dum crash his bike thing into Godzilla's mouth. And maybe that's it. But Herc has one good move and then turns into a complete idiot. He's impulsive, yes. He's vain, yes. Sometimes he acts without thinking, yes. But here it was just too much. And maybe I'm wrong. I mean, maybe the characterization was spot on. I'm not real familiar with Hercules in the actual continuity at this time in Marvel's publishing. But a simplistic story with a simplistic moral... Yes, Hercules throws Godzilla, but I can't recommend this to someone to read. I just... Ugh. However, it's better than what comes next. Part 4. Scooby-Doo, where are you? Human Fly number 2. October 1977. On sale date, July 5th, 1977. What have I gotten myself into? That's the question I have to ask. I'm going to preface all of my remarks about the Human Fly by saying that I am a big fan of Bill Mantlo, which I would think would be evident from our Rocket Raccoon episode that we did, which can be found at comicbooktimemachine.com/rocket-raccoon. raccoon. I think that's a good enough link. Anyway, I do. I like Bill Mantlo's work, and I'm excited about some of the Bill Mantlo material that's coming up in the future. I was excited about The Human Fly when I saw that it was written by him, and there's some comic books of his that I'm really, really looking forward to. This is not one of those. This comic book it's clown shoes. It's ridiculous. I expected the comic book equivalent of a late 70s, early 80s, primetime traveling do-gooder TV show. That's the kind of thing I was expecting when I was looking at the setup of Human Fly in issue number one. Instead, I got Scooby-Doo and the Laugh Olympics, or actually more appropriately for this issue, whatever that other cartoon was. Not the Laugh Olympics one, but the other big Hanna-Barbera crossover where they were all racing around the world, whatever that was. I'm so upset with this comic book. I'm not even going to do the comic book the service of looking up what that other Hanna-Barbera racing cartoon was. It doesn't even deserve the metaphor. It does a disservice to Hanna-Barbera to do. I mean, this was just bad. This was just plain bad. Now, I mean, the badness, it's foreshadowed on the cover. You have a picture on the cover of Ghost Rider and Human Fly. They're both on Ghost Rider's flaming motorcycle, and it's leapt off a cliff in the background, and it's heading down towards just a bunch of spikes that are just sticking up out of the ground. Okay, the drawing itself, it's not bad, but it's also just not good. And it's drawn by, this cover is drawn by Carmen Infantino and Al Milgram. And this comic here just kind of tells me this is where Ghost Rider went when Angel and Iceman said they didn't know where he was. I mean, this show is Godzilla and the Human Fly. They take place in the same universe. Anyway, Ghost Rider's here. And the bike is falling towards some spikes, and the cover hyperbole says, "The Human Fly teams with Ghost Rider in a death duel on wheels. Race to destruction." You open it up, and the splash page, it gives us the credits. Bill Mantlo, writer. Carmen Infantino, artist. Dan Green, inker. Irv Watanabe, letterer, and apparently colorist. And then Archie Goodwin, editor. I blame Bill Mantlo, and I blame Archie Goodwin for what we are about to embark upon here. Carmen Infantino, he shines. He's great. I'm reading the Trial of the Flash. It's a DC Showcase volume that has just dozens of Flash issues in it, hundreds of pages. This one long running storyline in the Flash, and Carmen Infantino is the artist. He's amazing. He's amazing. I really adore his work. I'm really starting to really appreciate him. I wish, again, like Jack Kirby, I wish I'd been paying attention earlier to his career. Anyway, we open with Human Fly. He's doing a stunt, and it's a ridiculous stunt. He's got two race cars side by side, and he's got his legs, his feet, jammed into these metal boots on either car. And so, basically, if one car would go just off to the side, it would just tear him in half. He's really putting his life in the hands of these drivers. But anyway, they're driving along, and remember, he's got 60% steel in his skeletal structure, and so he can I guess handle the stress. But they're driving. They jump over a huge tank of water, and on the surface of the water is an oil fire. And they jump over, but he releases himself from the cars. He drops into the water. Everyone's, oh no. And then he blasts a hole in the tank, and he's washed out of the side of that hole. And yay, he's alive! As if there was any surprise. After the stunt, Johnny Blaze comes up, introduces himself. And of course, Johnny Blaze is the Ghost Rider. And he congratulates Human Fly, and they talk about an upcoming race. And this upcoming race is why they're both happen to be there. Harmony White, the reporter who wants to bust Human Fly and reveal who he is to everyone, she is also there at this race. And I have to say, she is drawn beautifully. It's the facial structure that Infantino uses, and she's wearing these kind of green glasses and green tinted glasses, and she's got this blonde hair that's styled, and she's wearing this blue jumpsuit with bell bottoms. She's drawn beautifully, and you know what? Everything in here is drawn well, and so again, I just can't fault Infantino on any of this, and Dan Green, the inker. Can't fault him for this. I lay this squarely on the shoulders of Archie Goodwin and Bill Mantlo for this one. It just, oh man. Anyway, as back to the story, she is determined, bound and determined to bust Human Fly because she believes he's just this glory hound who's in it for the glory. He doesn't care about the kids that he says he cares about and that even the donations he's making, they're just for glory and all that kind of thing. So she is there and she has taken his story, which according to his story, he had a crash in North Carolina, and five men were hospitalized in the time frame that he has talked about. Those five men are her suspects, that they were all in accidents. Of course, if he's lying about his, you know, if he's just looking for glory and he's using the story, it's possible, Harmony, that maybe he's lying about his story about the accident too, and maybe he's not one of these five men. But she's convinced one of these five men is the Human Fly. And so the first one also happens to be there. His name is Alex, and Alex Marks, she is convinced that he's one of the suspects, and she actually sees Human Fly go into Alex Marks' trailer, where Alex Marks has his car, and he's there for this race. So she follows Human Fly, and when she goes into the trailer, Human Fly is gone, and Alex Marks is there. Busted! And I just can't help feeling, I've just been watching too much Phineas and Ferb with my kids, because Harmony White, I mean, she's totally just Candace. She's totally Candace, just trying to bust him. And she finds Alex Marks, and he's just, no, I can't be the Human Fly. Look at me. I can't even race again. I used to be the best driver in the business, and then I was in an accident. And he came, and he inspired me, and I healed. Everything healed except for my nerves or his confidence. And so he's not, obviously he is not the Human Fly. He came for the race. He doesn't have any confidence to drive in the race, but he came for the race. He brought his car and everything. But to quote the Cowardly Lion, he just doesn't have the noive. So what is this race? What is this race that Alex Marks has come to not race in, and that Human Fly and Ghost Rider have apparently come to race in? Well, it's actually called the Doomsday Race. The Doomsday Race. Oh, man. They did call it earlier. They called it the Daredevil Race. I got a little bit excited, but no. Daredevil is not coming. Spoiler alert. He's not going to be in this. Yeah. The Doomsday Race. Cyrus T. Barker. And with a name like that, you know he's got to be a carny of some sort. Well, he's the promoter. He produced the race. He's going to give $500,000 to the winner. The biggest event in racing history, he calls it. And he is there. He's there to make money, you know. And when we get into the race, we're going to find out, well, maybe they shouldn't have trusted this guy very much. I'm just trying to figure out, why are people even thinking about doing this race? Because the race starts. And the racers go, okay? And the engines roar, the mighty machines strain forward, shuddering like unbroken steeds against an unseen harness. And soon two racers take the lead, Johnny Blaze on his skull cycle, and Alex Marks, quote-unquote, in car number 7. He who now removes his scarf to reveal the grim visage and cool gaze of the Human Fly. Now, Harmony White has seen Alex Marks' car go, and she now knows, because he's in the race, he must be the Human Fly, because the Human Fly is nowhere to be seen. No one knows the Human Fly is actually racing Alex Marks' car. So the drivers approach the first obstacle, and the tension grows, and I'm thinking, oh, the first obstacle, interesting. And they have a bunch of thought clouds for all the drivers. One says, what kind of hazards are we facing? They don't know what kind of hazards they're facing. Where's the danger? They don't know where the danger is that's going to be coming to them. When do we hit the traps? This is all in one panel, by the way. And so it's been revealed to us, there's traps in this race. This is a doomsday race because there's traps in this race.
who will come through and who will fall.
$500,000 is a lot of money, worth almost anything. Yes, worth almost your life is what you're saying. Got to win. I've got to. Next panel, spikes come shooting out of the ground and just tear through the cars. I mean, literally through the cars. And I'm just thinking to myself, wait just a minute. They have just put themselves on this track that is actually actively trying to kill them. I don't know if they were expecting this or not. I'm assuming that they weren't. But how could anyone, I mean, Cyrus T. Barker, how is he not going to be held responsible? He set traps that can tear through the cars. It says, describe the gleaming spikes slash viciously, disemboweling these creatures of technology, gutting these wild stallions of tempered steel until they lie broken, torn, and twisted, or merely crawl forward, flames licking at their open wounds. But two vehicles scream ahead, though one trails fire in its wake. They just drove through an area of track, and it's not even track, it's like sand, it's dirt, it's not even really like it's not a racetrack, this is cross-country kind of thing, where spikes came up that were long enough to not just, you know, hit the car, but to go through the car, and stopping some of these at just, you know, breakneck speeds. I mean, they're going at racing speeds, and these spikes come tearing through, and I mean, they could die. People could die here. This is crazy. So this is where I basically turned against this book, because as ridiculous as some of like the Harmony White stuff is and stuff like that, it still feels like, you know, that 70s show. And then it just turns crazy town. It just takes that right turn right into crazy town. And the comic book puts on its clown shoes and says, hey, look at me. I'm a lunatone. Oh, my goodness. So they miss the spikes, although somehow, it doesn't show us how, but somehow Human Fly's car is on fire. So the flaming vehicle is not Ghost Rider. He has not turned yet. That's coming, though. They're going to go over a bridge. There's two bridges ahead of them. And a river. Basically a gorge kind of thing, where you would just go off a cliff. If you miss the bridge, you're going off a cliff. They had 10 cars lined up side by side to race to these bridges. And again, this is just crazy. This is so dangerous, so ridiculous. And this Cyrus T. Barker just thinks, I can get away with this. His whole plan is that the racers are not going to finish the race because it's so dangerous. And he's just going to be able to keep the money. That's the guy's plan. So they go across the bridge and the bridge flips on them. Ghost Rider hits a portion of the bridge and it literally, on his axis, just flips over and tosses him off into the water. And so as he's going down into the water, then we have the next bridge that Human Fly hits. Instead of turning on its axis to like flip him off, it actually spins around in the middle. So the middle section spins as if to, you know, if he would stop there, it would turn around and he would just be able to head back the way he came. But of course, he's going at breakneck speeds. His car is on fire. His brakes don't work. Again, we don't know how this damage happened. I'm assuming maybe some spikes hit or something. I don't know. And so he basically guns it and makes the jump and makes it across. Meanwhile, Ghost Rider comes out of the water and he's now Ghost Rider. He has, he's on fire. As he comes out of the water, though, the surface of the water catches fire because it's been covered in oil. Again, this Cyrus T. Barker is murdering these racers. This is the most public mass murder you could possibly imagine. And it's happening right in front of everybody's eyes. And Cyrus T. Barker thinks he's going to get away with it. Even if no one dies, this is attempted murder here. And so the racers start coming back, and Harmony White, she's curious, she wants to know what's going on, because Alex Marks and Human Torch are still out there, so she's going to nail him, she's going to nail Human Fly. The brakes are not working on Human Fly's car, so Human Fly has to jump off his car onto Ghost Rider's motorcycle. This is just, it's cartoon. It's cartoon stuff. It's just so bad. They go into a tunnel.
and the tunnel closes behind them, and then a giant fan turns on. And this giant fan does two things. One, it blows them out the other end of the tunnel. And two, it's blowing out the flames of Ghost Rider's motorcycle. So they can't stop. And the tunnel doesn't continue on to a road. At the end of the tunnel is just nothing. It's just a sheer cliff. And again, I'm thinking, these racers didn't get a chance to, like, take a look at the route ahead of time. This route goes literally, it just ends at nothing. So any racers who made it to this tunnel are going to fall off a cliff and die. This is so... Okay. Well, fortunately, we've got some quick thinkers here. The bike can't hold both of their weight because apparently the fan was just blowing the flames away. So a human fly jumps off the bike onto nearby power lines. Again, it just doesn't make sense. He uses his pimp cane to slide down the power line. Ghost Rider hangs onto his feet. They slide down. Cyrus T. Barker, man, he is just ready to get out of there. He goes to his place and he takes out the $700,000 that the race has made. He's going to make a run for it. Now, mind you, the page where they're sliding down the power line, that's the second to last page. So we're almost to the end here. And he says, I'm going to run. And out of the shadows by the safe steps Alex Marks. What? Who in? Alex Marks, you can't be back. Sure I can, Alex says. Since I never left, the fly took my place so I could keep an eye on you, the promoter of another race I was in, the one that cost me my nerve and nearly my life. I always suspected you rigged my car then, and now I... And Harmony White comes just in time to say, Alex, look out, he's got a gun! Which he's pulling out of the safe, and Cyrus T. Barker says, Hey, the Lady Snoop, you're next, Blondie, after... And then, walk! Suddenly, instinct propels Alex Marks. Instinct that existed before he lost his nerve. Instinct primed by anger and concern to overwhelm fear and burst forth again. And then we have our one panel wrap up, which basically sums up everything you could possibly want from a human fly story. And some hours later, Alex, you and Johnny are both winners. The prize money is yours, says a human fly. Of course, Ghost Rider says, well, we've already decided to give it to charity, fly, in your name. Sure, Alex Marks says. I can afford it, because I'm sure I'll be driving again. And then Harmony White, she's right there. And just a particularly gorgeous picture of her, she says. So Alex isn't the fly. Well, there are still four other suspects on my list. Clown shoes. Oh, man. That was bad. Laughably bad. And it just, oh, man. It just got more and more absurd. And not the good kind of absurd. Not the Hercules throwing Godzilla absurd. Godzilla number 3, at least, well, it had Hercules throwing Godzilla. Here, there is there's almost nothing redeemable. Except for maybe, well, no, not maybe. The art. Carmen Infantino. A beautiful, beautiful artwork. It just works. So... Human Fly, the wildest superhero ever, because he's real. And I just want to know, what did Human Fly think about this comic book? Oh, man. So, now it's time for our bonus content. Our next part is, hopefully, something good. And I do have to say, I consider something this bad... I don't consider this lost time to read that book because I did get some laughs out of it. As I was reading it, I was laughing at how absurd it was, but it's not the kind of thing where it's so good it's bad, you know, the kind of thing that I want to return to. Or maybe it is. Maybe in time it'll grow on me. And maybe in a couple years I'll be, you know, cleaning up my comic books and, oh, hey, Human Fly, and I'll look through it again and I'll see this one and I'll say, I want to read that one again because it was so bad. Maybe. Who knows? I don't know. I don't care anymore. I'm done with Human Fly number 2. Human Fly number 2. How appropriate. So, we're going to move on to something that I hope is good.
Part 5. It's not. Good, that is. H.G. Wells' The Island of Dr. Moreau is a Marvel movie special. It's 50 cents. And this is, well, okay. I'm just going to quickly go through the story. Dude gets shipwrecked on an island, finds out that he's on an island with a guy who has been performing experiments, giving animals human characteristics. This is a real problem. And so as the animals become more animalistic and as everything just goes to pot, dude escapes with a lady. And at the end of the comic, the lady turns out to be part cat. Now, there's a lot of stuff going on in here, and there's a lot of stuff they're trying to do. I did watch the movie after I read the comic because I wanted to be able to compare the two. And the movie is, from the makeup to the music to even a lot of the plot elements, it feels like they're trying to do a Planet of the Apes kind of thing. That could be a good thing. In this case, it's not. So the comic itself, then, the comic has, let's see how many pages are in here. So there's 48 pages, and four of those pages are behind-the-scenes things. One of those pages is a movie poster for this particular movie, and 12 of the pages are ads. That leaves us with 31 pages for stories. 31 pages. Star Wars gets around 100 pages. Roy Thomas knew what he was asking for. He knew what he was doing, man. Because this, The Island of Dr. Moreau, some of these pages have 11 panels. And I don't mean like one unusual page that's trying to give some sort of, you know, claustrophobic mood or something like that. No, multiple pages have 11 panels. There's one splash page at the very, very beginning. One splash page. And there's a couple pages that have five panels in them. Average is 7 or 8 panels per page. Now, I've read a number of movie adaptations. I don't remember any movie adaptation actually going and actually doing that many panels on the page. But then again, if, you know, this feels like they're kind of starting. They're not doing something new here. I mean, they've done Planet of the Apes, which it's been a long, long time since I read any of those comics. But they did do 2001 as a treasury book. They did Logan's Run as a 5-issue run. They did Star Wars, or are doing Star Wars, as a 6-issue series. And then Dr. Moreau gets 31 pages. Now, I want to give credit to Larry Hama, the artist, and Doug Minch, the writer here, for being creative with the layouts and everything like that, especially some of those pages. They have inset panels. They have, you know, thin panels that are doing like a time lapse of emotional reactions and that kind of thing. There's some really interesting storytelling going on here. They really, 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 really work hard to fight against the limitations they were given. So kudos to them for that. But this is definitely, it's not a failure of an adaptation, but it is definitely the weakest, because any thematic elements, it gets reduced, if not completely dropped. I mean, there's a whole idea here of what separates us from the animals. They're talking about technology and how technology has advanced, but humanity has not. And so then they're talking about, you know, the animals are becoming humans, and what causes them to be more human-like? Well, it's law. It's rules. And then those rules and those barriers break down, and the animals are becoming more animalistic. And the one thing that this does that the movie doesn't do, the movie cuts to credits right when they find a boat that's going to rescue them, whereas the comic book actually gives us, I think, what was actually supposed to happen in the movie, where it turns out that the love interest that he's been with that whole time, she's sleeping on the little lifeboat that they're trying to, you know, survive on, and when they see that ship, he turns around and she's more like a cat. They kind of hinted at that, but they never actually. And maybe I just missed it or something, but they never actually gave it to us in the movie. The movie, I don't recommend. The comic book, I don't recommend seeking out unless you're a fan of H.G. Wells or something like that. It's a curiosity. And for me, again, I'm getting stuff out of these conversations that I'm having with you, the listener. I'm getting stuff out of examining these adaptations because, again, that's a big part of what I do is adaptation. And I'm learning things about this. And so it's really interesting for me to look at Star Wars on one hand and then to look at this, The Island of Dr. Moreau, on the other. What I'm also excited about is I know there's some more Marvel movie specials coming up. And I'm not sure when it's coming, but I think that there's a Peter Benchley movie, The Deep. that they did an adaptation for. I don't know the date, so I'm not sure when that's coming. But I'm excited to see how are they learning themselves. Like I said, I've read movie adaptations. Some of them were DC and some of them were Marvel, but I don't remember any of them cramming this much artwork onto the page to try to make up for the fact that they only have 31 pages for story. So I give them credit for what they were trying to do here. And yes, I did not... I'm not ending on Human Fly number 2. I'm ending on a semi-success and something that I actually got to learn a little bit about. And like I said, the final book I read is always John Carter. So there's that. And I don't have any real, like, behind-the-scenes things about this comic like I've had for, like, Logan's Run and that kind of thing. Because this is just a work-for-hire thing. This is a studio saying, hey, Marvel, do our book. And Marvel says, yeah, of course we'll do your book. We're Marvel. We need money. Star Wars hasn't helped us out yet. And so, yeah, this is the start of something here. And it goes along with the just charting that licensed course that Marvel is taking. And this is the beginning of some of that. So I'm excited about seeing what's going to come. But for right now, we need to wrap this episode up. So it's time for the epilogue with the Bullpen Bulletin. Epilogue. The Bullpen Bulletin. And I like to end each episode kind of looking through the comic that month and just looking at ads and just seeing what kind of house things they have. And this one I was struck by, well, I'll just kind of go through it. First, right there on the back cover again, Dino De Laurentiis presents Orca. It's on Netflix, and I really, I haven't gotten around to it yet, but I'm going to be watching that in the next week or two. Maybe it's part of my October horror movie viewing. Okay, beyond that, Joe Weider still wants to build me a better body for just $7.98. It's nice. On the inside front cover, we have the Junior Sales Club of America. And I have to ask, did you ever, like I did when you were a kid and you had these comics and they had these pages with all these prizes you could win, did you ever just stare at those prizes and just say, oh man, I really wish I could have that. That'd be so awesome. There's the Telstar TV game on here. It's Pong, and it's, you know, predates the Atari 2600 and those kind of things. There's an instant load flash camera. There's a superpower hair blower. There's the Fonz radio. So you could sell things for prizes, or you could sell for cash. And these things always intrigued me. A little bit later in the issue, I can't get these things straight. You have the Youth Opportunity Sales Club. Basically the same kind of prizes there. They have a Kodak Pocket Instamatic camera. They have tennis racket, power van, three-piece skin diving outfit. And then you turn a few more pages and you get Grit. You can, he says, remember how many times you felt left out because you were broke? Well, now you can make $2, $5, $10 or more week after week. Introduce Grit. And so another, you know, just preying on that poor kid mentality. And then finally we had, I think it's here on the back cover. Yeah, there it is. Olympic Sales Club Incorporated. Earn prizes or cash the easy Olympic way. And they, again, have there's a Gorilla radio, electronic football game, Goodyear blimp clock or something. I don't know what that's meant to be. Anyway, I was struck this time. Four of those type of ads were in here. I don't remember having that many. I do remember Grit, and I remember Olympic in the comic books that I had when I was a kid. I don't remember the other specific ones. I just remember seeing those and just staring at them and thinking, I want that. So then you have just a ton of, I don't know what these pages are called, and I'm coining a phrase right now, and I'm hoping that I'm actually making it up in my mind and that it's not someone else has already, you know, said that call them this, and I don't know, and I'm not crediting them. But anyway, I call it a flea market page. I think that's what I'm going to call it. I was just trying to think of what are some different places. I was going to call it a mall page, but it just didn't sound right. But a flea market page sounds about right. And you just have all these different ads, people selling comic books, people selling live seahorses, people wanting to have you send them your poems so you can have your poems set to music. You there's a high school course at home, customizing your van inside and out, all that kind of thing. Steve Buscema is still doing his comic book art class, and Stan Lee is still going to be a guest lecturer. And there's also a house ad for subscriptions. Subscribe to the Superheroes. 12 issues of your favorite title for $4. That's your first subscription. All following subscriptions will cost 50 cents less than regular price. $3.50. That's pretty amazing. And I'm just amazed at how cheap it used to be. But when I was a kid and I'd see things like that, it seemed out of reach. It seemed out of reach. And the other thing I've been trying to take notice of, but haven't had in the last couple of months, there's been Twinkie ads, but it's not the kind you'd expect. It shows two kids with baseball gloves and baseball hats, and inside their glove is a Hostess cupcake or a Twinkie. And basically on the back of Hostess Twinkies and cupcakes, there are full-color baseball cards printed on the bottom of the box, and you can cut them out and trade them and do things like that. I remember cutting out baseball cards. I don't think it was this particular set, because 1977, I was only 3 years old at that time, so I wouldn't have been. But yeah, this is... I've been waiting for more comic Twinkie ads, and I just haven't... I've only had one, and it was just that awkward one with that Madam Web. Bullpen. The bullpen bulletin, Stan Soapbox, talks about the KISS Super Magazine, and then they also introduce that they're getting a whole bunch of new Hanna-Barbera comic books. Maybe that's what this is. Maybe they have a bunch of Hanna-Barbera titles that they're going to be publishing, and maybe they were just trying to tie into that with the Human Fly. Maybe that was the issue. I don't know. So anyway, they also mention a volume 4 in their origin series, which was called Superhero Women, and I did not know that existed. I have the other three. I have Origins of Marvel Comics, Son of Origins, and Bring on the Bad Guys. But Superhero Women, I'm really curious about that. I would like to see that. And then there's just a whole bunch of things, talking about, new creators and different books. Marvel Premiere is going to be introducing Weird World, which is a fantasy series I'm very curious about. They actually talk about if you're thrilled to Tolkien's Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, you got a hunch this is going to be just what you've been waiting for. Well, I'm very curious about it. So beyond that, honestly, I don't have too much more to say other than my special announcement. And what is my special announcement? Well, I'm pulling out the annual, and I'm talking about it in another episode. And in that episode, I'm also going to be having an interview. An interview with someone connected to John Carter of Mars, the Warlord of Mars. Who is that special guest? Well, his name is Marv Wolfman, and I'm going to be interviewing Marv Wolfman as a special episode that ties into this annual, and I am so excited to be able to do this. And he has been very gracious, and we have set up a time, we've set up a day. I just, if all goes well, I'll be interviewing him, and that episode will be coming soon. I don't know when that episode will be released. It'll probably be released at the beginning of October. I can't imagine it being released any earlier than that. So all that said, we're done then. We are done with this month of Marvel Sci-Fi. Please remember, if you want to find all the other episodes, you can go to comicbooktimemachine.com/Marvel Sci-Fi. And you can find me, if you want to get a hold of me, you can find me at benavery.com. But you can also go to comicbooktimemachine.com, and you'll find contact information there. And finally, I want to promote a podcast that I've been listening to. I like to do this more often, where I talk about other people's podcasts. And so this episode, I would like to talk about Mark's Mess podcast. Now, Mark Adams, he does a few different podcasts. One of them is not related to comic books. It is a new podcast that he's just started that's actually letters from his family during World War I. It's very interesting. But anyway, as far as comic books go, he has done a series about the Evolutionary War, which we've mentioned before, but he's also doing a new series right now about Atlantis attacks. It's very informative. It's very interesting. He gives you some history and background and stuff like that. I really have enjoyed the Evolutionary War episodes that I've listened to. And I really enjoyed the first episode of the Atlantis Attacks series. So just go to marksmesspodcasts.blogspot.co.uk. That's .blogspot.co.uk. And you can find some links to where you can get to his podcast. And I recommend it. If you like what we're doing with the Comic Book Time Machine, you're going to like, I think, Mark's Mess Podcast by Mark Adam. He's like an honorary time traveler. In fact, maybe that's what I'll call this. When I recommend a podcast, especially a podcast like his, where it's not connected to ours at all, but just by its very nature is connected to what we do and the spirit of what we do. And so, Mark, congratulations. You didn't ask for it, but you're an honorary time traveler. So, all that said, I need to find some words of wisdom to leave with you. And I'm not going to quote from the books here. I'm just going to point out a lesson that I learned in reading the books here, and that is, if you are ever asked to take part in a race called the Doomsday Race, and they don't let you look ahead at the track, and they tell you there's going to be traps, maybe, just maybe, that's a race to avoid joining, even if there is a cool $500,000 in it for you. This comic book stops to put on its clown shoes and then buys a ticket to go on the crazy train. And at the first juncture, it takes a left toward Crazy Town, stopping in Crazy Town only to hitch some more circus cars on there. And then it goes through a tunnel, and then the comic comes to the end of that tunnel and flies out the exit where there is no tracks. There is no nothing. They weren't looking ahead. And then they land in the Wacky River and the... Wacky Races, that's the name of the show. Rats, wasn't gonna... Well, can't stop myself from remembering, I guess.